Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Peter Singer, the director of the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence and a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. He served as coordinator of the Obama 08 campaign's Defense Policy Task Force and as a consultant for the United States Department of Defense and FBI. He lectures frequently to U.S. military audiences and is the author of several books, including Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution, and Conflict in the 21st Century. His latest article at the Los Angeles Times is, Finally, Obama Breaks His Silence on Drones. Well, it happened. He broke his silence at the National Defense University. And what's your takeaway from it, Peter?
Well, it's interesting, too. You have to judge the speech itself and then the act of giving the speech, which are different things. So the speech itself, I thought it was a very good speech. Now, remember, I'm coming at this as a policy guy, as a policy wonk. This was a very substantive speech. In many ways, the president was not giving a rallying cry. This wasn't one of those soaring emotional speeches. He was really making a case, you know, and it reflected, you know, the professor and lawyer that he's been in the past. I mean, he would lay out a point. He would say, here's the advantages, here's the disadvantages, and then here's where I come down on it as commander-in-chief, given the responsibilities that I have. It was a very meaty speech, a very long speech. I mean, this was an hour-long speech. So, you know, I think it was very effective for that purpose. Now, more important than the speech itself, though, is the act of giving the speech. The president has been caught in a strange irony where he's one of the best communicators of his generation, and yet he's kept quiet largely on one of the key issues that's come to define his administration's foreign policy, maybe even his administration's place in history, and that's the issue of the drone strikes. And there have been, you know, references that he's made in a couple of late-night talk show interviews. His attorney general talked about it. His CIA nominee talked about it. But the president never laid out his case for it, never laid out where he stands on it. And that's very important, not just in thinking about this in public perception, but also inside of government. You know, you have this interagency process, and you have the CIA versus the Pentagon versus the Department of Justice versus the State Department. And essentially, by the president giving the speech, it's the culmination of them working the process to say, this is where we stand on it. And I'm the president, and this is where it goes. And, you know, you can see this, for example, in the way he talked about whether the war on terrorism is over or not, or how much longer it will go. You know, there have been people in his administration in recent weeks who've said everything from, oh, if we, you know, only get 10 to 20 more folks, then this is all over, to others saying this is going to be 10 to 20 more years. He's standing above that and saying, this is where the Obama administration stands on it. And so that's, I think you have to judge it in that manner as well. The very act of giving the speech was important in setting the tone, not just what was in it.
Well, he said, but this war, like all wars, must end. That's what history advises. It's what our democracy demands. So at last, somebody has changed this open-ended global war on terror, where we responded to a hopeless fanatic with an endless war.
Yeah, this was not a speech where he was standing on an aircraft carrier with a big poster saying mission accomplished behind him, nor was this the thing saying, well, it's going to last forever, and you know the fears that people have of, you know, you can do anything anywhere and there's no control of it. Again, he went into pretty deep depth on where he sees the challenge. I mean, here's an example. When he talked about the evolution of Al-Qaeda and the terrorist threat, how it's changed since 9/11, you know, he broke it down into categories, fleshed it out with instances, you know, compared the differences between how Al-Qaeda Prime, the core, has evolved since 9/11 versus the threat from regional organizations versus the threat from homegrown or lone wolf actors. I mean, again, you know, he went, you know, this is not the kind of substance you normally see in presidential speeches. And what he was, in essence, trying to do is strike a balance between saying, look, terrorism is with us for the long term. There's not going to be some kind of victory parade. And yet, the kind of ad hoc structures driven by a lot of short-term thinking that we built up after 9/11. Guantanamo would be a classic example of that. But, you know, whether he openly admits it or not, some of the directions of the drone strike campaign would be also in that. It's him saying we can't have these kind of ad hoc approaches for the long term. That was the balance he was trying to strike. Another way of putting it is that he was trying to make a case for the regularization of a not just post 9/11 counterterrorism strategy, but a post bin Laden counterterrorism strategy.
There was, of course, somebody that wasn't at all silent, and that was the co-founder of Code Pink, Medea Benjamin, who interrupted the president. And when she was dragged out, she said, "Can you tell the Muslim people that their lives are as precious as our lives?" And the president did respond to her at length and said, "I'm willing to cut the young lady who interrupted me some slack because it's worth being passionate about." Then he told the audience, "Guantanamo has become a symbol around the world of an America that flouts the rule of law." So this is, you know, obviously a pretty strong marker he's placing down here. But why can't he close Guantanamo? That's why the protesters are outraged. They assume that the president of the United States can do it. Why can't he do it? He's wanted to do it from day one, apparently, but he can't do it, or he hasn't done it.
Well, let's tackle this in a couple instances. First is kind of the sad thing that's happened with some of these groups, and that even when they've got good points to make, the tactics that they've gone about it have undermined their points. And I think we saw that illustrated today. Look, show some respect. And you have your opportunity, your voice to be heard. I mean, what was funny and sad at the same time about it was, one of these illustrations of America. She pops up, she screams and yells, and president listens, and then she sits back down. Everyone's like, okay, you got it out. Then she pops up again. It's like, come on. And it was one of these things where, again, I think they're undermining the strategy. It's disrespectful. And then the funny, you know, weird thing about it was she's screaming out, "Close Guantanamo," in the very midst of the sentence where he's saying, "And this is how I want to close Guantanamo." And then you get into the second part of the question you asked, which is the political realism of this. And it's understanding that, guess what, protesters, guess what, rest of world, we don't live in a dictatorship. There is this thing known as the three branches of our government. And so even when the president might want to close it down, there's this other thing known as Congress. And so this is one kind of an unrealism on their part of thinking, you know, snap your finger, it's going done. I bet he wishes he had that power. But the other part of it is the question of how do we judge this speech and this strategy? The speech itself, Professor Obama would probably, you know, give a very good grade to it. But strategy is different. Strategy has to be judged by its implementation and by how it survives, you know, as the German military historians would say it, first contact with the enemy. You might have the best strategy in the world, but after it has contact with the enemy, that's really how you can judge it. And the enemy in this case, so to speak, is everything from the terrorists themselves to the enemy and the plan and the strategy to shut down Guantanamo is the other branch of government, is Congress, which has resisted it. And that's where you saw the president doing a couple of things. He was laying out his case not just from a right and wrong issue, saying, you know, I don't think this is a right thing. It's contrary to our laws. The Supreme Court has found, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He was also saying, look, you've been willing to let me carry out a fairly active counterterrorism campaign. I think I've proven my bona fides. I've gotten bin Laden, et cetera. Well, I'm telling you, Guantanamo is not helping. It's harming my counterterrorism strategy. So he's making that kind of argument. Then he's trying to appeal to something else that Congress traditionally cares about, which is money, saying we spend $1 million a year per prisoner. And on top of that, we have this request to spend almost $250 million more on upgrades to this prison that I and my past opponents in Republican presidential campaigns have both said is not good for the nation. And oh, by the way, it's at the same time that the budgets for everything from the Pentagon itself to school lunch programs are being cut. So, you know, he's in essence making an investment-based approach of saying there's arguably no worse investment we could make than spending $1 million a year on prisoners in Gitmo. So, you know, that's what he's arguing. But again, that argument hasn't fully worked in the past. We'll see how it plays out in the coming weeks with Congress. Some of the other things he offered up, a couple of them were symbolic, like saying, oh, I'm going to appoint a high-level official to supervise this. You know, that's more symbolism than, you know, really able to drive substance. There were other parts that may be a little bit more substantive down in the weeds. For example, him saying, I'm going to re-examine the process of everything from how to do military commissions back in the United States at a U.S. military facility to looking at how to send more prisoners back, including reopening up Yemen as a potential destination. And that opens up a wider set. So these are kind of down in the weeds things, but bottom line, the Gitmo part of the strategy is going to be harder for him to implement than the drone part of the strategy.
But isn't it pretty clear that the majority of the American people, I believe it's up to 80%, are quite happy to have the president use drones anywhere and everywhere, and they've given him a blank check. It is only a minority of the country that is outraged by both the moral implications of what's happening and also, I suppose, to a lesser extent, the geopolitical implications, because after all, the war on terror has been in many ways a blank check to the Assads and the Mugabes and all of the dictators around the world, particularly when it came to torture during the Bush-Cheney era, where every two-bit dictator in the world can say, well, you know, the Americans torture, so what's the problem? So I think we paid a price. And if it wasn't for the Medea Benjamins of this world, do you think the president would be acting? In other words, nobody's pushing him if the majority of the people are in favor of the use of drones and are happy to keep Guantanamo open. I mean, I'm accurate in that, aren't I?
I'm going to agree with you on one part and disagree with you on another part. So the disagree part is, no, I don't think someone popping up and screaming is what drove the president of the United States to give this speech, oddly enough, at the very same place the person popped up in the speech. I don't think that's what drove it. I think it's the realization that this is, and regardless of the polling and the policy world, there is the realization that a series of ad hoc measures, be it Gitmo, be it the way they've gone about some of the drone strikes, they've come with long-term questions, long-term consequences, and what we were doing in an ad hoc manner was not sustainable. I don't think that's something that claiming that, you know, I don't think Code Peak can claim success by any means for driving that discussion. Just, it would be unfactual. Where I would agree with you is the broader part of understanding that every action comes with consequences, first, second, third order consequences. And an example of that would be, you know, whether it was the torture debate or drones or whatever, that you may do something thinking that you're doing it for the right reason, but it opens up a series of cans of worms. I think, you know, one of the ways the president talked about it was that sometimes whether something can be argued as legal doesn't make it smart. And that would be I think that would apply to, you know, for example, let's go back to the Bush years, the way they would bend over backwards arguing that things were legal, and we could go back and forth on, you know, whether it was true or not, but we could agree that it had consequences that were not smart for us. And again, it's not just looking inside of constitutional discussions. It's also the way that other governments take our precedents, take the way we operate, and then either model after it or even misuse our precedents to legitimate what they're doing. And I think that's one of the other aspects of audience here that matters, the audience that mattered in this speech. You know, while in the U.S. we like to think about things in terms of, you know, the domestic poll numbers, like you referenced, the two audiences that mattered way more. One was, as I mentioned, inside government, the president staking out to the interagency where it's going to be. And the second is internationally, where as these technologies proliferate, like drones, and as our allies keep coming back to us and saying, we need you to resolve these situations. We can't cooperate with you on counterterrorism in the way that we might want because of Gitmo, because of some of the things that are happening on the drone side. Basically, it's the international side of this matters as much, where the president, by laying out a broader strategic approach that, you know, I would argue is a lot more sensible than maybe where we were 10 years ago, what he's trying also to do is rebuild that coalition on the international level.
But in terms of the interagency, what flexibility and what power does he have to make unilateral decisions? You're saying that
in the interagency, the president has the power. You know, to the funny thing here is this speech. The president, you know, we judge presidential speeches by the, you know, Reagan-esque communicator, but it's more, you know, this one will thrive or fail dependent on his role in the decider side, in order to echo the Bush side. So in the interagency, at the top of the executive branch, he's got that. The problem, which again the protesters don't seem to get, is that there's these other branches of government that are not part of the interagency. So, you know, guess what? There's certain members of Congress that he may say, I think Gitmo is a waste of money. I think it's a harm to national security. And these are the ways that we might solve it. But the president doesn't, for example, own the checkbook. Congress does.
So when the president says then that this perpetual war, the U.S. war on terror, whether through drone strikes or special forces operations or troop deployments, would be self-defeating, how does he get that message then to this incredibly hostile Congress? You're suggesting here that he's trying to make pragmatic as opposed to moral arguments here.
I think he's trying to hit on, I'm not saying he's doing or. I think he's trying to hit on all levels. Again, right. when he talks about something like Gitmo, he's referencing everything from counterterrorism strategy to he doesn't think it lives up to our ideals, which is a moral value type judgment, to then he makes legal references about the inability to utilize certain systems there versus how the civilian law system has continually worked for, as he put it, in many situations, even worse terrorists. And then he's making just a bottom line checkbook argument saying, I don't think the investment of $1 million a year per prisoner is really all that a great investment. So he's trying to tackle it on multiple levels. Will that work with a Congress that has, you know, been fairly intransigent? I don't know.
Well, just in closing, surely I think this not only isn't an intransigent Congress, this is a Congress that hates this man and doesn't want to give him any kind of victory. So at the end of the day, do you think the protesters should turn their ire on the Republicans, who are really responsible for keeping Guantanamo open?
I think they've done that. I mean, I've been at congressional hearings where they popped up and did the same screaming. That's kind of the problem of when you when you scream at everyone. You start to get ignored. And let me be clear, there's a difference between protest and some of the silliness that's happened here. So that's my own take. I mean, you have a broader question, which is I'm still confused as to how this happened. You know, this was not a speech like at a university. This was a speech at National Defense University, which is a military base. So, you know, this wasn't like walking off the street kind of situation. So I'm sure we'll have a lot of, you know, news stories focusing on how did this play out. But, and that's, you know, let me go back to where we were at the start. This was a strategic speech. This was a substantive speech. This was not a speech about the optics. This was not a speech about soaring rhetoric. And so I hope we take it in that way and then also don't get distracted by some of the silliness that played out. So, for example, you know, there was this scrum of media gathered around the one person being dragged out where literally you couldn't see the person because of all the iPhones trying to take pictures of them. And that's, you know, that's what the media is going to do. But the point is we just listened to an hour-long case laid out for the future of American counterterrorism. Let's wrestle with that.
Well, Peter Singer, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
All right. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Peter Singer, who's the director of the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence and a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings Institution. He served as coordinator of the Obama 08 campaign's Defense Policy Task Force and as a consultant for the United States Department of Defense and the FBI. He lectures frequently to U.S. military audiences and is the author of several books, including Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution, and Conflict in the 21st Century. His latest article at the Los Angeles Times is, Finally, Obama Breaks His Silence on Drones. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about new evidence that undercuts the Department of Justice claims that some bankers are too big to jail.